Good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of the Library Environmental Committee, thank you so much for attending our speaker series this afternoon. My name is Heidi Schroeder, and I'm a librarian here, and I'm also a member of the Library Environmental Committee, the sponsor of the speaker series. Today, we are honored to have Dr. Frank Tulewski here to talk to us about Traditions Through the Trees, Trees on the MSU Campus. Dr. Tulewski was born in New Jersey and earned his bachelor's degree with a double major in biology and chemistry from Montclair State College, his master's in botany from Ohio University, and his PhD in tree physiology from Wake Forest University. Both his master's and doctoral work focused on the influence of wind on tree biomechanics, growth, and development. Before coming to MSU, Dr. Tulewski held positions at the University of Arizona, the Buffalo and Erie County Botanical Gardens, and the State University of New York at Buffalo. He joined MSU in 1993 as the curator of the W.J. Beal Botanical Garden and Campus Arboretum, and as assistant professor in the Department of Botany and Plant Pathology. Currently, he is professor of plant biology and curator of the W.J. Beal Botanical Garden and Campus Arboretum. He has published over 40 peer-reviewed articles, numerous book chapters, and is internationally recognized for his work in tree biomechanics and tree growth responses to wind. He has given numerous talks nationally and internationally with an emphasis on tree growth in response to wind, tree biomechanics and hazard trees, proper planting practices, and more. Please join me in welcoming our very distinguished speaker today, Dr. Frank Tulewski.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for that wonderful introduction. That's a long way and a long time here at Michigan State, but it's been a very good journey so far. And I just want to point out a couple of people here in the audience today, because no man is an island, and I believe it may have been Isaac Newton that said, you know, because I can see further, it's because we stand on the shoulders of giants. And so Paul Schwartz is our campus arborist. I've been working with Paul for the past 22 years here at Michigan State, trying to save trees, protect trees, and keep trees happy from all sorts of perturbations, including football games. So if you see the Protect Our Trees, No Parking, Please signs, that's actually a program Paul and I initiated back very early in the 1990s to try to change the tailgating culture here at Michigan State. Because, again, our trees are a very strong part of our tradition here at Michigan State. I'd also like to recognize Jeff Wilson. Jeff is my right hand, and if without Jeff, I'd be completely lost. He's our IT guy. Most people probably say that today about their IT folks. And Jeff's really helped significantly with the database and helping me get the database and making the database accessible, functional, and usable. When I came here, we had multiple databases for the tree collections, and in the mid-1990s, we unified it all into one single database, and Jeff played a significant role with that. And, of course, Peter Carrington is my assistant curator. Most of you probably know Peter because he's spoken to this group many, many times before, and is absolutely wonderful, well of knowledge and experience. And Dave Wilbur's here. Dave's one of our landscape architects over in IPF, and Dave joined just a few years ago.
Six years ago.
But we work very closely again when there's construction projects on campus. Paul and I and Dave or some of the other LAs, Deb Kinney or Tressa Wall, will go out and evaluate trees around a construction site, determine which ones should be protected, which ones should be avoided, and which ones can be removed. So it's not an easy decision. I never like, and Paul never likes, having to make a decision to take a tree down on his campus. But inevitably, we have to. But I think the very important thing is realizing that, you know, when we look at Michigan State, and we realize that not only are we the founding land-grant institution, which involves so much of aspects of agriculture, horticulture, and forestry, and botany, but we have a very long tradition of planting trees on this campus. And the campus is recognized, if not the most beautiful, one of the most beautiful campuses in the United States, if not North America. And many students come here specifically because of the beauty of the campus and because of the greenness of the trees and the surroundings. And certainly we all know our favorite song, MSU, I Love Thy Shadows, Beneath the Pines We'll Gather, if I got that correct. Somebody can correct me if I didn't. But again, so, you know, when we refer to the pines when that song was written, I almost wonder if that didn't have maybe more to do with spruces, because a lot of lay people confuse spruce and pines. They're evergreens, right? They are both in the Pinaceae, but they are different genera. So, but anyway, again, just recognition of Michigan State University's trees, contribution to its history. And I hope they give you a little bit of some background, and there's so much more to talk about and tell than what I can cover here in the next 35, 40 or so minutes. So anyway, of course, we're all familiar with Beaumont Tower, and if you don't know about Beaumont Tower rests where the original college building, College Hall, was built early on in MSU's history, MSU being founded, of course, in 1855, College Hall being built shortly thereafter. The bricks were made from clay excavated from Sleepy Hollow, and that's that little patch of that little depression of land just across Circle Drive from the Beale Botanical Garden, and that is part of Beale Botanical Garden, by the way. We'll talk a little bit about that in a bit. But the building wasn't built of the best quality back on the frontier days, and so it was, I heard one story from our archaeologists that there was actually a tree trunk that wasn't removed but just built around the foundation. So when the tree trunk began to decay, it kind of lost some of its mechanical stability. So one of the reasons why College Hall no longer resides there, but why Beaumont Tower was built in 1928. But what's very fascinating is that when College Hall was built, people were planting trees on this campus, and we can see this tree right here. Was planted when College Hall existed. And this tree right here is a ginkgo biloba. We'll talk more about these in a little bit. Was there in 1863. So, again, some very important trees. And we start out, some of the earliest information I could find out about planting trees on campus starts with Professor George Thurber, who was professor of botany before Professor Beale. A lot of people always talk about Professor Beale being the first professor of botany at MSU, and well, you know, again, I'm not a perfect historian on the academics at Michigan State, but, you know, I have some questions for anybody who is. But if we go to the archives, you can find out that Professor Bogue served at Michigan State Agricultural College from 1860 to 1863. And as part of a general plan to introduce exotics to campus, okay, there were trees being planted while he was on staff. And if we go and look around Beaumont Tower, again, we see the ginkgo biloba, this beautiful ginkgo tree. We see some of the Norway spruce, and of course, our bald cypress, Taxodium disticum, up there. Going through the records, and I'm trying to continue, you know, part of my job for the past 22 years in my free time, is going through archival records, paper records, trying to piece together the puzzle of MSU's tree history, because there's never been a comprehensive and consistent record keeping for our campus plants. There's been fits and starts, but some of the annual reports are the best place to look. And one of the most exciting things that I ever had is I knew this ginkgo tree was fairly old, but when I found in one of the annual reports that it was a gift from Professor Acer Gray at Harvard University to Professor Thurber and Michigan Agricultural College in 1863. So this tree, when you go out and look at that tree up there on the west side of Beaumont Tower, have some reverence for it. It's 1863 that tree was planted on campus. And the thing that's even more exciting, for those of you who know a little bit about MSU history, Professor Beale just so happened to be a student of Acer Gray's at Harvard during that period of time. And I'm sure that I would think that Professor Beale probably didn't really have a whole lot of thought that he'd be on the faculty at Michigan State. Because I know any graduate student who's hoping to be a professor has absolutely no idea where they'll end up, because the job market, I'm sure today, as it probably was back then, is just pretty uncertain. You just don't know. It's wherever an opening happens to be. The Norway spruces, actually, were planted a little bit after Professor Thurber came on campus, but I found a record that in 1865, 350 Norway spruces were planted on campus and 150 white cedars, so Thuja occidentalis and Picea abies. I haven't been able to find anything on this Taxodium disticum, but it heralds back to about the same time as these other trees were planted on campus. So one of these days, hopefully, I'll find some records on that tree as well. But again, if we look at today, literally today, this picture was taken not less than about an hour ago, but we can actually see where those trees reside around Beaumont Tower. And so here's that Taxodium. Unfortunately, the Taxodium and the ginkgo, more so the Taxodium, got beat up this past year. You know, we had a very bad ice storm on the 21st of December last year. And then we had several trees that were probably weakened by that ice storm right around where I'm standing. And it was a huge, old, beautiful tulip poplar that unfortunately was hollow, so we couldn't get a date on it. But it collapsed, and it also took out part of an oak tree next to it, and everything fell in this direction, so a lot of the branches unfortunately got stripped off. But the tree seems to be doing okay. And again, Paul's crew went out very carefully trimming these up to make sure that the wounds are had the best chance for sealing up and compartmentalizing. But again, so there's the bald cypress. Here's the ginkgo tree. Lost all its leaves already. You can see all the leaves right there, the ginkgo leaves. And right here is the Norway spruce, an 1865 Norway spruce. And right behind all those trees would have been College Hall. Well, some of those 18, they planted 350 Norway spruces back then. That's, you know, that was a lot of Norway spruces on campus. And here we see Cole's house, what it looked like. And this is circa 1874, according to Madison Kuhn's book. Madison Kuhn wrote a book on the centennial, 1855 to 1955, the year I was born, about the history of Michigan Agricultural College. And he has this picture in that book. And we can see two beautiful Norway spruces here on the east side of Cole's house, and we have several Norway spruces up here. And then this is what they used to call Faculty Row. These were all faculty houses that were built. Professor Beale actually lived in Cole's house for a period of time. For the first few years, it was the president's house, and then they built a much more eloquent president's house and turned this into a faculty house. And so that was Professor Beale's residence until the old house that used to be the president's house, the new house that used to be the president's house, was torn down, and now this has become back to be the president's residence here at Michigan State. And used quite primarily for greeting guests and donors and VIPs who come to visit the campus. So a very important part of our campus right there at Cole's house. But if we take it, if I was Mr. Peabody, I'd have my Wayback Machine, and we could actually go back and actually see these for real. But we don't have a Wayback Machine, but we can go back and look at where the trees are. And so look at how much the campus, the North Campus, has changed since the time that that first picture was taken. All the faculty residents are gone. Of course, these dormitories were built in the 1930s. Landon Hall and Campbell Hall and Mary Mayo Hall. And so forth, Gilchrist Yakeley, all built up in that area. But if you look at this tree here, question mark, I'm not sure if it's exactly the tree I had in the previous one over here, but it's one of these, okay? And if you look at these Norway spruces here, there's two or three Norway spruces currently hidden right back in here. You see them right there? So very possibly that they are some of these trees right in here. And, of course, we can see the two original trees right here and here, right next to the Cole's house, right there. But these trees were not in existence back then. There were a few older trees. Now, remember, when Michigan State was founded in 1855, this was pretty much a forested knoll. The oval up here is quite a nice sandy knoll, remnant of glacial geology. And there was a forest there, and it was cleared for agriculture and cleared for the college. And so you see these trees that were once forest trees here and here. And notice that, we'll talk about that in a little bit, that they were topped, okay, as an experiment. We'll talk about that in a bit. But again, these were, you know, they wanted to try to get the trees to spread their crowns out rather than being these tall, spindly forest trees. So that was an attempt at a little bit of arboriculture. So we can take a look at the Beale Garden, and the Beale Garden we can see very interestingly, this is way before the building we're in is standing up. This is the old Wells Hall over here, which used to reside about where part of the library is, the eastern part of the library. And this is the depression that is part of Beale Garden, a little bridge right here. We figured this may actually be a young Professor Beale, taken in the 1870s. And the botanical laboratory would be right behind us, the building. And there's a memorial marker right outside there, right by the gazebo at Beale Garden. That's basically where we're looking at. But again, kind of keep in mind the spruce trees back here. There they are in this postcard. Okay, so this is a postcard of the Wild Garden. Here's Wells Hall. This is the old chemistry building up about where the fountains are today. And here's another shot. Here are the two spruce trees right here. This is taken a bit early. The postcard's copyrighted 1904. Who knows? I don't know exactly when the postcard was written. I'll have to flip it around and look at the postage stamp on the back. It'll tell me. But anyway, kind of fun. This person was obviously studying hieroglyphics. She puts a little bit of...
Circle Drive.
Where's Circle Drive? Circle Drive would be behind me. So Circle Drive's up over about here. What I kind of like about that, we always talk about, you know, how people, you know, text and use tweet and all this Twitter and all these little, you know, LOL and all those other fun things. Well, you know, they had abbreviations back then, too. So this may be an original tweet. But if we look at the botanical gardens today, and lo and behold, we can see those two beautiful Norway spruces here and here. Of course, here's where we are. I'm up here someplace giving a lecture right now. Here's down at the garden shed. So the original garden shed was a little log cabin, and the original ponds were just original little bits of oxbow from the Red Cedar River, natural pond areas. And we see, again, this beautiful Norway spruce, and we see this really nice western red cedar right here. And if we look at the garden today, literally this morning, we can see that big Norway spruce. We can see the little red cedar right over here. The new garden shed is right over here, but where this little trellis is where that log cabin was originally. So you can kind of get an idea. You're trying to do a little, you know, relocation photography. I was doing kind of quickly, so, you know, it'd be fun to do this a little bit more accurately. But now if we switch around and we look at the other side, this actually predates the building of the log cabin. But again, there's the big spruce tree. This is the botanical head house. There's a greenhouse here. This is, all, of course, all where the library is today. You'll see that in a second. But keep your eye on this tree right here and the western red cedar right here. And here we are today. And here's that big, beautiful Norway spruce. Here's the library, which is supplanted or replaced the greenhouses. And then the little red cedar is growing right here. And, of course, the beetle shed right there. One of the fine traditions that we have here at Michigan State are planting what we refer to as commemorative trees, or some people call them memorial trees. We like to think of commemorative because that's more of a broader term, commemorating an event or a person, as opposed to just memorializing a person. And this is truly I put memorial tree, look at that. This is truly a commemorative tree because what it commemorates the birth of President Abbott's daughter, Mary, who was born on January 10th of 1863. And so he planted this white pine, which is up in the northwest corner of Cole's house today. It got pretty badly damaged in the ice storm, too. But again, thanks to the good care from Paul and the tree crew, they were able to clean it up. And I think we should be able to get another few decades out of it easily. But it keeps growing. But again, this white pine was the first commemorative tree planted on campus by President Abbott in honor of the birth of his daughter. And it's really kind of fun is that she was married underneath this tree in 1883. And if we go back for a quick second, and that tree is actually right there. That's Abbott's white pine right there. So Cole's house being right here, again, that's the northwest corner of Cole's house. So Professor Beal came to Michigan State in 1870, having finished up his work at Harvard and finished up a short-term career at the Friends College, Friends School. In upstate New York, and he founded the Botanical Gardens in 1873. But also shortly after that, when you look at his early writings, shortly after he arrived on campus, he was very actively talking about the need to start an arboretum and a botanical garden on campus, which he did. And so, of course, the Beal Botanical Garden, which was named for him in 1924 in recognition of his work and at the time of his passing. But again, we can kind of talk about one of the experiments Professor Beal was involved with was this tree topping experiment. And so, again, it was an idea to try to get the trees to get a fuller, more open-grown crown. Unfortunately, we still have the evidence that Paul and I have to deal with here on campus. And so here, right across the street from the library, you see the tops taken out of this tree. The same thing, this tree right here, the red oak by the library, by the museum parking lot, also was topped. So, but, you know, it kind of worked. I mean, you know, it got a really nice growth. Branches and the squirrels and raccoons are really happy because they have a place to live. But unfortunately, this is compromising the strength of a lot of our trees, and we've lost a number of trees on North Campus because of that. We do have a program though that I've started with the nursery manager who was here, Tim Boland, many, many years ago, back in the 1990s, and Jay Andrews, our current nursery manager, and I are still working on it. It's called the Heritage Tree Program. And so every fall, we go up, and depending on who's producing, you know, seeds, acorns or nuts or whatever, we collect those, and we grow them up out at Beaumont Nursery in recognition of some of the original gene pool, some of the original genetic material we have from the trees here on campus to plant them back on campus. So kind of one of the fun things that we do. Professor Beal is involved in a number of aspects of the campus. Of course, the Beal Botanical Garden, which he founded. The Campus Arboretum, which has been called Deer Park, is located right here between Mary Mayo and Campbell's Hall. That's a little group of trees up there. If you've ever wondered what that is, that was actually started in 1874 when Professor Beal planted two rows of swamp white oaks. I'll talk a little bit of that in a second. Professor Beal is also involved with certain management aspects of the Sanford Natural Area and the Baker Woodlot Natural Area, which today are Category 1 campus natural areas used extensively for teaching and research by a lot of our students. He also, in 1896, planted the Beal Pinetum as part of his experiments in reforestation in the state. And so these are major areas across campus that he had been involved with. Professor Beal is also involved with East Lansing in terms of developing some of the housing areas north of campus. But again, I don't have too much of the history on that. I focus mostly on the campus. Now, one thing that was interesting about these woodlots and why they were managed is that, again, back in the 1870s, 1880s, we didn't have natural gas. You know, we didn't have, you know, fuel oil, let alone electricity. And so how did the students stay warm? Wood stoves. Okay? And so if you were a student here, not only did you do your studies and take your exams and go to lectures, you also went out there and split firewood and fed the wood stove. And unfortunately, there are way too many examples of disasters associated with heating with firewood because the old botany lab burned down because the wood stoves set something on fire. Don't know if the student was drying their socks on the stove or there was a chimney fire or what, but it happened. Saints Rest was one of the original dormitory buildings that was located just to the east of the MSU Museum right now. And there's a marker there. There was a little bit of an archaeological dig a few years ago on that. But again, it burned down for the same reason. So heating with wood out on the frontier, and this was the frontier back then, was a dangerous proposition, but it sure beat freezing to death. So anyway, those students would work in those woodlots, cutting trees and cutting firewood. Just real quickly, this is a little bit of an older map of North Campus, Cedar Red Cedar, and I use this to kind of show where the Beal Botanical Garden goes and what the original Beal Botanical Garden was like. And so when we talk about Sleepy Hollow being a part of Beal Botanical Garden, this is actually where Beal started his work in growing plants experimentally, and he had several plats of grasses and forbs that he was experimenting on. And actually, the literally, pun intended, the roots of our turf program are right there. So MSU's well-known turf research program was founded right in Sleepy Hollow. And that was in 1873. Later on, he expanded into this portion of the drainage that flowed through the gardens, a creek that flowed out of East Lansing. And in about 1876, 1877, with the Beal Botanical Garden. But because this is all one unit, we give our founding date as 1873 in terms of when the garden was founded, because this is the first part of the garden that actually started there. And if we look at a close-up, we can actually see that garden. Those spruce trees that I showed early on are up over here. The garden shed is over here with the trees, and up on top here would have been the greenhouses. This is actually Sleepy Hollow. That's why I did the previous map, kind of shows where that actually goes. But he had that on his map that he planted. But the garden had a much different layout back then. You can see that he had all the kind of meandering paths going through the garden, and again, arranging things taxonomically, systematically. So he would have the figworts, the scrofularias, the liliaceae, the lilies, the ranunculaceae, the roseaceae, all the variety of families of plants, categories together, so he could use it literally as a teaching laboratory. So the botanical garden was a living laboratory. It still is today a living laboratory. I shouldn't use the past tense. Shame on me. And so here's an early shot of the Beal Botanical Garden showing that little creek that flows through the garden. And here's the little bridge, and we saw that little bridge in one of the earlier photographs when we were looking down into the garden off of the bank. And the garden today, of course, is much different. And major difference is there's no creek. And about 1900, 1905 or so, they began to backfill the botanical garden, and they built a brick-vaulted storm sewer over the creek. And then they backfilled soil on top of that to raise the garden, the level of the garden. So the original level would have been several feet lower, and certainly as you got closer to the Red Cedar River, it was lower than we were up here by the stairs in Circle Drive. So much so that back in the early 1870s, 1880s, there was actually a stone arch bridge across that creek at this particular point back here, where we have this broken concrete wall now. And of course, that was all backfilled, and you know, the bridge is long gone. And I was hoping when we were doing construction work on West Circle Drive last summer that we would have found some of the remains of the bridge, but apparently we didn't find anything. It was kind of sad. It would have been neat if we did. But the couple of things of interest, of course, we'll talk about the Katsura tree here, and of course the Metasequoia tree over here. We'll talk a little bit about those too. But again, here's another view of the garden, looking down into the garden. Well, we'll look in a few months when spring comes back. So we'll get a little bit of greenery out here. Here's that beautiful Katsura tree. Again, a couple shots of the garden historically. Again, some of the ponds. It's kind of fun to go down here and try to match, you know, photographs up. But Professor Beal, again, started the Arboretum in the fall of 1874, and it's located, as I said, between Mayo and Campbell Halls. And unfortunately, a few years ago, this tree got struck by lightning. It was a beautiful pencil of green ash. And then after it got struck by lightning, emerald ash borer came in. So unfortunately, we had to remove that tree. That tree no longer exists. But I was contacted. Tom Keeler, some of you may recall Tom Keeler, was the former director of Campus Park and Planning. And he called me into his office one day shortly after I arrived and said that our new president, President McPherson, wanted to build a residence college and wanted a building location, a building site to put an administration and classroom building. And he was looking at this little woodlot between Mayo and Campbell Halls. And said, you know, and Tom informed me, he says, well, you know, historically, you know, our understanding is that's the original Arboretum where Professor Beal started everything in 1873. Can you do some work and kind of document that? And so I took that under my wing. And fortunately, working quite a bit with the old historical records and archives and agricultural reports, I actually found out that, lo and behold, I found an actual planting plan, row by row, that was typed up by a professor in the horticulture department from Professor Beal's original notes. And I went out there and I was able to actually locate all the existing trees and document them. So Father's Day of 1995 or so, I get a phone call, 6 o'clock in the evening. My wife comes out, Frank, it's the president. Bill? No, Pete. Oh, okay. So, you know, Mr. President, yes, can I help you? You know, Frank, you know, my wife and I would like to go out and visit your woodlot. So, okay, that's fun. So we went out there. I met him at Cole's house, and we walked over there, and you know, I told him about the history of it, and he told me about his vision for, you know, developing the university and the school. And I told him about the history and the importance of this woodlot, and he told me that, you know, as a developer and such, that what he does. And then his wife kind of stepped up and said, Pete, I think Frank understands and appreciates what you're trying to do. Just don't do it here. And so that woodlot's still there. And those trees that Professor Beal planted starting in 1873 are still there. The thing that's really exciting is that when we look at that area, and sometimes it's good to take pictures in the fall because of the foliage doesn't hide other trees, but you see this tree right here? You see this tree right here, and there's another one just around the corner from it. These are Quercus bicolor, swamp white oaks. They are, I would, if somebody had to ask me to, you know, stake my life on an opinion, these are the oldest trees on campus. And how do I know that? These trees are in Beal's original handwritten records as being the trees that he collected the acorns off of to plant his two rows of swamp white oaks, 1, 2, on 4-foot centers, okay, in the fall of 1874. So in the fall of 1874, these trees were old enough to be producing acorns. How old are they? I haven't cored them. I don't really want to core them. I only core trees when I absolutely positively have to because it does cause a wound. I haven't seen a whole lot of instances where trees have died because of that, but again, we try to be very good stewards and try to minimize any intrusions that we don't have to take. Oh, yes, they're native. They are originally grown trees. Those are original campus trees. They were here before MSU was even, you know, probably they were here before settlers came to Michigan, would be my guess. So they would date back, I would guess they date back into at least the late 1780s. That's Mayo Hall. So, again, the tradition of the trees. Think about this. Look at how close these trees are to the foundation of this building. This is a huge building built in 1933. And yet, the university took the care to protect these trees so they would not be damaged. And this is a legacy Paul and I continue on today in terms of protecting our trees around construction sites. We see that green fencing, that white fencing around it. Paul and his tree crew are responsible for doing that. So we take that very seriously. It's a wonderful thing, heritage that we have. He also planted white ash. There were three rows of white ash right in here, and then we see the sugar maples. Again, you see the two rows of sugar maples as they're going down, a little bit of a different angle. There is two different images here. Don't think your eyes are going crazy. But again, there's some beautiful black walnuts back in here, absolutely beautifully straight black walnuts that he planted and so forth. But now, because of that record, I can tell you exactly what year each one of those trees were planted in the 1870s. And again, just kind of gives you a little bit more of a broader overview of it with the paths going through here. And this path actually dates back to the time of Professor Beale. In Professor Beale's notes, he kind of complained about how the students were beating a path through his arboretum and all the litter that was being left behind as the students would walk to East Lansing. So not a whole lot has changed, has it? Paul, we deal with it all the time. I don't even want to think about what the landscape services crew does on football Sundays because they're here cleaning up the mess.
You know approximately where the fences were, where they kept the deer and elk collection?
Yes, that's why. That's a good point. This was called Deer Park for a reason because in the 1890s, Professor Beale was the professor of botany, then botany and horticulture, and then botany and forestry. And that's why sometimes they hear him talk about tripling in brass because he had those three major departments here at Michigan State as a founding person. Horticulture was the first to spin off his own department. And the department chair of horticulture made this decision that we need to have a deer park, an elk park on campus. And so they actually had fenced off the southern part. And so the southern part that was fenced off, probably the fence went through here, going south into what's the parking lot right now. And that's probably why they just cut everything out of the parking lot, because the deer and the elk, what do deer and elk do to wonderfully delicious trees in the wintertime? Okay, if you live out in the country, or maybe not so much in the country, you know. Buck rub, nibble, chew, and so forth. And so, again, reading Beale's old notes about his consternation about having this deer park installed in his arboretum, he was not a happy camper. So I can empathize sometimes with Professor Beale. But Professor Beale, to take a little bit of diversion here, was also very interested in the cutting over of Michigan. A lot of Michigan went to rebuilding Chicago after the Chicago fire. Professor Beale was born in Michigan, down in Adrian. He's a Michigan native. He saw a lot of the forests cleared for farm fields, and he saw a lot of the conifer forests up north cut for lumber. Professor Beale and Liberty Hyde Bailey, who was a student of his at the time, and several other people went across the northern part of the Lower Peninsula from shoreline to shoreline, doing a survey of plant material, trying to figure out how can we best utilize this land that's now being sold to immigrants coming in to settle this area and make a living off it. Well, when you have 300 feet of glacial sand under your feet, there's not a whole lot you can grow once you remove the forest. And that became evidently clear. And this is kind of what this is the Grayling Experiment Station. We actually had an 80-acre experiment station up in Grayling, Michigan. As you go up 75, just at the confluence of 23 and 75 come together, there's an exit that goes into Grayling. You go up and over the interstate, and you come down the Grayling. It's on the east side of the interstate highway, right there by the industrial park, where the old experiment station used to be. But this is what the land looked like. It was cut over. There were a lot of forest fires that would go through and burn the slash off and kill anything that was trying to come up. Some places the oaks would stump sprout and come up, and then it would be very ratty kind of land, and you couldn't really do much with it. And so in the 1877, Professor Beale did an experiment, and to the best I can tell, it's an unfortunately unheralded successful experiment in North America, because it's probably the first true silvicultural experiment, predating everything that Harvard, Yale, and the folks down at Biltmore ever did with growing trees. Because in 1877, he set up three different experimental areas, one where he extensively weeded and plowed the land, planted trees, the other one where he just spring harrowed and planted the trees, and then a control plot. And I had a graduate student of mine, Jason Kilgore, did his master's degree and finished up this research 100-plus years after Beale started it, and it was very interesting to see what happened, because he planted native and non-native species, broadleafs and conifers, very interesting stuff. We're running low on time, so I will not elaborate more. But again, part of Beale's contribution, that's why in 1896 he planted the Beale Arboretum, the Beale Pinetum, was also an experiment at growing white pine, and planted things a little bit further apart this time than on four-foot centers. A lot of the stuff was on four-foot centers. By then, he moved to a 10 by 12-foot centers. And so if you go over there, you'll see those white pines are on rows. But again, here's a nice color picture of that tree in full leaf over there by Mary Mayo Hall. Of course, the red cedar is a wonderful natural corridor that runs through the campus. We have tried to implement an invasive species removal program, certainly along the garden portion where we have it. We got it pretty good under control, but still trying to do some work with landscape services to try to get a better control on the invasives that are along that area. There's a lot of buckthorn and lonicera growing there, and we'd like to see more of our native vegetation growing along our riparian area. But again, we certainly were capable of preserving some of our newer old buildings, and this, of course, is what we call Laboratory Row. All the various buildings. Of course, Eustace Hall over here was the first horticulture department, and this building was designed by Liberty Hyde Bailey. There's a nice memorial, commemorative plaque right there that read, this is old botany and old forestry and old entomology departments. So was it Chittenden that's being dedicated tomorrow? Yeah, so rededicated. So they just did a lot of refurbishment work. It's nice to see. But one of my favorite quotes of Professor Veal, I think this raising of forest trees is a promising field to demand our attention when these different kinds of trees are well started. Some people of our state will want to learn how each variety thrives that they may plant also. And one of Professor Veal's comments, that's actually his writing. So that's the way they spoke back then in 1876. And then of the various things attempted since my connection with the Agricultural College, few have given greater satisfaction considering the outlay of time and money than the selection and growing of trees, 1886. So Professor Veal was very much an advocate of trees, forestry, and planting trees on campus. Professor Bogue, 1902 to 1907, was the first professor of the forestry department when it spun off. They were afraid that they were going to lose the Beale Arboretum on North Campus. Talk about being pathetic, but fortunately we were able to save it. And so they started planting trees down where International Center and Wells Hall are today. And if you look down there, you can actually see trees in rows. If you're over at Erickson, there's a group of red pine that are planted in rows. All of these are part of the Bogue, what we like to call the Bogue Arboretum. And, of course, our ever-watchful squirrels that we have here on campus to take care of our trees. But there's larches. We have ponderosa pine, we have Pinus sylvestris, a whole bunch of trees planted there. And these plantings actually extended all the way over to the football stadium, because if you go to the football stadium and you look over there on the east side of the stadium, you'll see planted in rows red pine, and there's also some limber pine and Douglas fir over there are planted in rows as well. So those all date from about this particular time. The beauty of the campus was a very important aspect for the campus, and many of the campus presidents felt it was important to conserve. At one point in time, Central Park landscape architect, Olmsted, Frederick Law Olmsted Company, was the brothers were actually consulted for preserving the pastoral appearance of campus, but Glenn T. Phillips, who was our consulting landscape architect in 1925 to 1945, really had probably the largest influence of conserving the campus and the campus beauty through this crucial period of time. And just about the time that President Hanna, John Hanna, came onto campus. And so we see a lot of these classic old designs. A lot of this had to be refurbished in recent years up here, but with the red buds and the dogwoods giving MSU its notorious and well-respected beauty. For the woody plants on campus. We work with other arboretas and collections around the world. For many, many years, Professor Beal worked with the Arnold Arboretum and the Kew Gardens to bring plant material and the USDA to bring plant material to campus. It's a tradition that continues on. In the 1950s, when Milt Barron was in charge of campus park and planning, and George Parmalee was the curator of the garden. In 1954, they had acquired a seedling of Metasequoia glyptostroboides, we planted it down in the garden. That tree is still there. Just a few years ago, we installed lightning protection on it. And unfortunately, when the folks from the crew that installed that got up there and informed us, it had already been struck by lightning. So fortunately, it looks like it's going to survive, and we can prevent any future damage from that with that lightning protection. But again, the story of Metasequoia is a wonderful story, Peter may have given a talk about that down on one of his garden tours at one point in time in terms of how it was known from the fossil record, discovered by a forester in China Seeds were collected and sent to the Arnold Arboretum, and the Arnold Arboretum then distributed those seeds and seedlings around the world to test it to see how well it is. This tree grows in Los Angeles. I mean, if you go to UCLA's botanical garden, there's one of the same, you know, from the same group of trees growing out, you know, there in LA. So it's very, very tolerant of a number of environments.
How old is it?
Well, we planted ours in 1954, and I'm not sure how old it was when we got it, but they got the Harvard got
the first seeds came out in 46.
46. So they would have germinated in 46 or 47. So, you know, it's old, but not that old. It's over 100 feet. It's 102, 103 feet tall. Yep. It's a wonderful tree. Milt Barron was curator of the garden from 51 to 55 before he was the director of campus park and planning. Milt, unfortunately, just passed away just a few months ago. He lived to be 101. Amazing. And his mind was incredibly clear. I would go and consult with him and talk to him about collections quite a bit. It's a big loss for us. But Milt Barron was a true plantsman. He went to Harvard for his training after the war and was hired on here at Michigan State to do the job that he did, and he did it well. And he also was very interested in plants, and so he introduced a number of plants, Sorbus acuparia, Cardinal Royal, the English oak, Westminster globe, the Skymaster oak, just sugar thyme maple, and that's probably his most common and probably his most well-known introduction. We have many sugar thymes planted on campus. As a matter of fact, in dedication to Milton, Milton actually came over to see it, we planted sugar thymes over at the old horticulture garden when we replaced the old crab apples that had deteriorated over at the old hort gardens as a dedication to Milt. And, of course, Malice American Spirit in 1989. So Milt was an incredible person and did a lot of work. Between him and George Parmalee, running Beaumont Nursery and planting all kinds of unusual plants on campus, this was sort of the golden age of MSU plant diversity and experimenting with many things. Many things they experimented on and just didn't survive. But how do you know unless you test it? You know, if you read Durr's book on landscape plants, Durr even talks about, you know, you got to try it. You don't know until you try it. And that's what they were very active at doing. So, again, a major, major contribution to the diversity of campus in terms of plants. Again, our Dawn Redwood is what it looks like in the fall. James Hanover, who was our geneticist of forestry department, a professor of forestry, did quite a bit of development, and we have two of his wonderful contributions on campus. The Spartan spruce, which is a cross between the blue spruce and the white spruce, blue spruce and white spruce, and these two are growing right up here by Cole's house, so up on the north. Northeast corner of Cole's house, just on the other side of the driveway, we have these Spartan spruces. The American spruce, which was a cross with a white, red, white, and blue spruce. He did that for our bicentennial. And so the red, white, and blue spruce are American spruce. And one of these was actually planted at the White House, but I think that may have gotten blown over or knocked over in an ice storm or a windstorm recently, so it's unfortunate. But our American spruce is down as a memorial tree, a commemorative tree for Professor Hanna, down over by Natural Resources Building. So we have that on campus as well. So some wonderful contributions in terms of forestry and trees. So again, the value or the purpose of our collections, what we do, the curatorial staff working with landscape architects to maintain the diversity of collections, to ensure that we bring new plants onto campus that are introduced or that we feel that can grow on campus, evaluating them, of course, hopefully they're not invasive species. And we try to avoid those. But again, new cultivars and new varieties that have been produced in the trade, as well as keeping the diversity of the collections as well. We are very well known for our crabapple collection, thanks to Milt Barron and George Parmalee. We are featured in several books, especially the book on the genus Malus by Father Phyla. And a few years ago, I instituted a program because, unfortunately, some people on campus were looking at, oh, it's just a crabapple. And again, because we didn't have very good plant records and very good tree inventories and very good tree maps, it's a crabapple. What do you mean it's just a crabapple? You know, so I worked very hard to try to figure out which crabapples were which and which ones were unusual. And some of them, a lot of them we have on campus, we only have one of a kind. And those no longer exist in the trade. And so I've been working with a propagator over in South Lyon. And every year we take signwood off of these rare trees and we propagate them and we're growing them up at Beaumont Nursery. Again, as a curatorial practice to conserve these trees, it's very important that these trees be conserved. And why they have value? Because our collections are very important for research, teaching, and outreach. Last year, mostly using woody plant material and some material from the Beale Botanical Garden, our plant collections, living plant collections, supported over $10 million in externally funded research for researchers here at Michigan State University who are looking for plants that, you know, looking for the DNA, looking for the secondary products, chemistry. You know, what does that relate to in terms of their research? So a very important component. For teaching, you know, literally hundreds, thousands of students a year utilize the collections in their classes, everything from landscape architecture to horticulture to forestry to plant biology in our ecology classes. And even the gardens and the plants are used by our art students coming out, do photography, to do sketches and so forth. So, I mean, medical students, we have medical programs that we run in the garden as well. And outreach, the tree labeling program, which unfortunately we've fallen behind on, but with some new support now from administration, hopefully we'll be able to catch up on that as well and get some of our tree labels updated again. But when you think of how many students, high school students, elementary school students, pardon me, come to this campus every fall to work on their tree collections, their leaf collections. I learned that very early on, my first year or so on campus, on a very cold and rainy October afternoon, Saturday, when I was walking out to get a bite to eat and crossing over Circle Drive, and I couldn't help but notice this car pull up, stop in the middle of Circle Drive. Little boy gets out from the back of the seat, runs up to a tree, looks at the label, writes down, picks up a leaf, runs back into the car. The car goes maybe about 30 or 40 feet. The car stops again. Little kid runs out, runs up to the tree, looks, writes it down. And I said, this is incredible. And I said, what are you doing? Well, every year, students who are, and I know it was the fourth grade, are required to do a leaf collection. And so we literally have, hundreds of elementary school kids coming to this campus because it's a documented collection. I just hope they pick up the right leaf, because the leaf on the ground may not necessarily be the leaf in that tree. But it's a good probability, so it's kind of fun. So very important work that we do.
Right.
Yeah.
The ginkgo, they're collecting ginkgo leaves.
Yeah.
You might mention that. Using the ginkgo leaves for research?
Oh, well, that was a project that we were working on. One of the other researches that includes in that $10 million worth of research. But again, secondary products chemistry, looking at the chemical that's synthesized by the ginkgo leaves, which is cheaper to harvest from ginkgo leaves than it is to artificially synthesize as a base molecule that's used in the production of medicinals. So again, I mean, we have some really, really, very brilliant scientists on this campus who are very innovative and keeping that spirit, that the university was founded on in terms of its land grant mission. And what can we learn from plants and what can we use for plants to make our life better? Just because we have genetic engineering and technology doesn't mean that living plants are obsolete. No, we still have to go back to them because we use that new research to further our knowledge in this particular area. But again, in addition to the educational value, the campus is also known for its aesthetics and campus beauty. It's a beautiful place. And that's one reason. I mean, a lot of people I've talked to say, when I got off the bus, my freshman year, when I was, checking out campuses and I walked across campus and I saw how beautiful and how green it was, and that's it. That's where I want to go to school. What a marketing opportunity. I mean, and the Alumni Association knows that because they hear it from people. Again, South Campus, people used to joke, how do we get South Campus to look like North Campus? Cut down all the trees on North Campus. Yeah, no. We don't want to do that. We want to get the trees on South Campus to look like the trees on North Campus. And so we've embarked on a lot of projects in the 1990s. We removed all the compacted soil from along Shaw Lane between the Bogue Street Circle and Hagedorn Road. And if you go down there and you look at those trees, the oak trees, the maple trees, and so forth, they're doing wonderfully well. They're putting on some really good growth. So if you have the proper technology and you have the proper horticultural and arboricultural practices, we can get trees to grow in disturbed urban landscapes. And that's one of the things that we've been working on. Unfortunately, my sequoia dendron that I planted in 1993 has a wonderful story because it was part of my high school science fair project seeds. And got them to germinate in 1993, 20 years later. This winter, got it. This last winter. Very, very strange winter. But the Mescalis canadensis is still there. We also lost our cedar of Lebanon, but we have a Cedrus deodor that's on the other end of the garden out by Kalamazoo Street, and it was completely untouched. It's just as happy as a lark. So that's a Himalayan species. So anyway, questions? Yes?
You know who I am, but for the guys who don't. Susie Techmeyer, forestry librarian. We get here in the library questions about the certain collections, like where's a crab apple collection? Where can I go find a black bullet? Are there any plans to create a like a brochure of some common species, not the ones that you want to protect from people like cutting their own science or anything like that, for the public so they can go around and find these sort of
Some of my colleagues are rolling their eyes because they know exactly what I'm going to say. It's been my dream for many years since we started mapping every tree on campus to make this available on the internet. There was a brochure, but the brochure is no longer accurate, plus the amount of time to publish a brochure and the fact that you can't get every tree into a brochure. I want to get this up on campus maps, but it's never been given a priority. Other things have gotten priorities as opposed to tree mapping. Now, hopefully, maybe in the next year or two, but I've been saying that for how many years, Jeff? We'll be getting... Well, not quite 93, maybe 95, but at least two decades. Hopefully, maybe this year or the next year, the IT folks that we're working with will finally have an opportunity to get this up on the internet. And if there's anybody who asks you a question about that or needs information, please feel free to pass them along my way, because I am the curator, and I can handle those. By the way, I wanted to also recognize Susie, because she's gotten some information to me. She's talking about those old paper records, but that the old thesis that you found with all the phenological records from the 1880s, and I was actually able to relocate the trees based on the descriptions in the thesis, two trees that are still existent on campus, and backdate our tree records with those phenological records from over 100 years ago. So that's very exciting. And that's work that still needs to go on. I mean, again, my problem is that I've got many, many things I'm doing, and that's always kind of, you know, on my free time kind of project. But it's always fun to work on that aspect. Yes?
That brochure was wonderful. I remember going around and checking off all the trees I found. I've used it ever since.
We can give you an old one. We still have quite a few left. Yes, I do.
Do we know where that is? Or?
It's dead.
Jones. It's dead.
What happened was, remember when I showed the picture of Faculty Row? The Roosevelt Elm was planted about where, is it Gilchrist-Yakeley? Mm-hmm. Is today. And so when they built Gilchrist-Yakeley, that tree was threatened with being cut down. Can't blame Paul and I, we weren't here yet. And so what actually had happened, that this is the first record that I'm aware of an attempt by the university to actually move a large tree. And so they literally tried to B&B this big elm tree that was planted a couple decades earlier or so by Roosevelt, Theodore, Teddy. And they slid it across into the oval up here by Adams Field. And It just continued to decline. It just, it's like the first heart transplant, you're successful a little bit, but today heart transplants are easy. Well, University of Michigan just spent $600,000, $400,000 to move a big old oak tree. We'll see, hopefully, how well it takes. The big old beech tree out here, that was moved as a mature tree back before I got, just before I got here in the late 1980s. Obviously, it's doing very well. We moved a very large beech tree from Beaumont Nursery over to the clinical center in the garden, the healing garden over there. Massive tree. It's done very well. So that was a pioneering effort. Unfortunately, it didn't work. There is wood from that tree in the MSU Museum.
Oh, yeah. It used to be in the union.
Okay. The cross-section. Yeah. So, yeah, people have asked me about that, and I finally said, I better do some research on that so I can answer that question. So, yeah.
Dr. Polchin moved here.
That's the one I'm referring to. That's the healing garden right over there at Clinical Center. Yep. Yeah.
What about some of the exotics? I work with a lot of international students and scholars from mm-hmm. Asia and mm-hmm. China in particular, and they're always excited to see some of the older specimens of what they know from their own countries. I heard a rumor once that President Shaw, who was Hamas' father-in-law, right, had some connection or had collected some things from China. Is that true?
I don't know. about that. That's an interesting lead. I could look into it. The katsura tree, we've had some scholars from Japan come through, and we've seen that's a katsura tree. Like, that's the biggest katsura tree we've ever seen. Apparently, they don't get that big in Japan. But there's a very interesting story I was going to tell, and I didn't, but since you bring it up, if you've got some time. That tree, does anybody here know Jane Taylor? Remember Jane Taylor, founder of the 4-H Children's Garden here on campus? Okay. Jane's retired. She lives up in Maine now. But when I came here, Jane was an absolutely wonderful person and gave me a lot of history, oral history of the campus. And she came and says, that katsura tree was brought to Michigan State by a professor from MAC who was sent to Japan at the request of the emperor to establish a Western-style dairy in Hokkaido at Sapporo. Wow, that's really interesting. Well, it's urban legend as far as I'm concerned until I can actually find proof of it. But, you know, Jane's pretty good with her facts. So I kind of sat in the back burner of my mind for many years. And then we had a young lady come up by the name of Cynthia Drew Redman. And Cynthia Drew, her father, Professor Drew, was the chair of the botany and plant pathology department in the 1950s. Okay, late 1940s, early 1950s. He actually worked during the war looking for cinchona in South America. Has a very nice memoir that he wrote about those efforts that his daughter got published finally. But she said that there was a family connection to katsura. She wanted to have a memorial recognition for her father for the work they did. So she wanted to put a bench in the Beale Botanical Garden in recognition. So there's a bench underneath the white pines over here. If you look at it, it says, you know, Drew on there, Drew Memorial Bench. The tree has a family connection. Really? Tell me more. I mean, anytime somebody's got a connection to a tree, I want to know more about the story. Well, my grandfather, Brooks, was a student of President Clark's at MAC. President Clark, MAC. Massachusetts Agricultural College. And Professor Clark, in the 1880s, was contacted by the Emperor of Japan to start a Western-style agricultural college in Sapporo on the island of Hokkaido in Japan. And when he went over there, and he spent several years coming back and forth. You know, he couldn't take a 747 back then, so it must have been quite a journey across the Pacific. Setting up this college, bringing back plant material, because, you know, again, agricultural college. Well, then, when he was finished there, he assigned this to his student, Brooks, Dr. Brooks. And so the great-grandfather of Cynthia's started putting two and two together. It was her great-grandfather who sent the katsura to Beale to plant in the Beale Botanical Garden. But it had to be planted after the garden was backfilled, because when you look at the katsura, the root flare and everything is perfectly on top of that. So it had to be planted sometime between 1905 and 1910. But again, so I mean, what a wonderful connection. So now Jane Taylor's story was confirmed, and we actually have it in writing now because I've been in touch with the folks at University of Massachusetts. But it was Massachusetts Agricultural College, not Michigan Agricultural College. So fun little stories about that. So again, we have many Asian species that are very well behaved on campus in terms of they're not invasives. People often ask me, why don't we focus on only planting native trees? We need to be sustainable, and sustainability means we have to plant native species only. And I'm sorry, I disagree with that. I think what we need to do is we need to avoid invasive species. If a species is going to get out and start doing damage to the environment by competing with other species and replacing them, then we have an issue. And there are some species like that, buckthorn and lanicera and garlic mustard, just to name a few, are ones that we are trying to eradicate and trying to control as best we can. But they're all over the place, and it's going to be difficult to really get that under control. But, you know, ginkgo tree, katsura tree, we don't see those taking over. Yeah?
In the JSTOR Global Plants Herbarium Database that's online, they also have a small section of correspondence. And in there are letters from James Beale to Director Hooker of Kew.
Oh, really?
Requesting science and seeds.
Oh, I'd love to see those. I know he's referred to those in his... Yes, he's referred to those communiques in his annual reports to the Board of Agriculture, but I've never actually seen letters. I did see his Darwin letter. His Darwin letter's wonderful, but anyway.
The letters are there, and you
yeah.
can see them.
Wow.
But I was curious, do you know if we ever received anything
Yes.
that we may have the dialogue?
I don't know if we have anything that survived that we've gotten from Q, but Beal did mention some of his annual reports, but it'd be cool to tie that together with the letters because the letters would be much more accurate.
I can send you the link on how to
get Yes, please do. Yeah, that'd be wonderful.
Now, did Beal first get lost in the fire?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, unfortunately, Beal's archives were in a garage, and the garage burned down, and that's why I was so excited when I found that the horticulture professor had actually typed up a list from Beal's notes of all the trees planted in the Arboretum. If he hadn't done that, I would not have been able to verify what's up there at the Beal Arboretum up there at Deer Park. Yes?
Do you have a comment about the beautiful crab apple that was cut down from in front of the new stadium addition?
Stadium addition. No. I could comment, but I'm being recorded. We try very hard to preserve the trees that we can. We have some beautiful specimens on this campus. If they're in the way of a prominent construction project, my first and foremost concern is the collection. And if we have others of that variety in the collection genetically, then I'm not too worried about it. I've seen some wonderful specimens that I've really hated to see go. We lost what I thought was a wonderfully old redbud down over biochemistry for part of the EFRIB project. But it was right where the utility lines went to go. We talked about possibly moving it, but again, the cost and everything. And the tree was not in perfect health. So we have to, we literally have to weigh and balance all of these things together. On the other hand, some of you may or may not know that there's in the old Bogue Street median, which is between EFRIB, and the Wharton Center, there were several beautiful white oak trees. And we were informed in the planning office that there was nothing that could be done. Those trees have to go. We have to put the building there. And I argued, and with my colleagues in horticulture and botany and forestry successfully, and petitioned the president so that those trees were saved. It was a matter of moving the foundation over 5 feet. No, we can't do it. We can't do it. Oh, yeah, we can do it. Now, we compromised. We lost two really beautiful trees. But we saved five trees. So sometimes, it's give and take. But again, the thing is that we have an audience. We are listened to. We are given consideration. And it's not that we're fanatics. We're a little bit of tree huggers, but we're doing a job that's been done for 150 years. We are the stewards of this campus. We are the stewards of this collection, and we take it very seriously. We love our trees, and there are many people here who love the trees also and look to us to defend those trees when we have to. There are times where, there's not much we can do. There's going to be a project. If we can move the tree, we'll move the tree. If we can work around the tree, move the foundation, we'll move the foundation. If we can't, then what's the genetics on it? And is it something that we have in the collection and we need to save it at least and propagate it? So the Katsura tree down in Beal Garden has a very bad issue with its structure. It was damaged in an ice storm in the 1970s. It's got a decay column in it. We pulled in experts. Paul and I had an evaluation done on the tree. I think it was Bartlett Tree did the evaluation. They made recommendations on how to do the cabling and put bolts to hold the tree together. The tree's been saved. We do what we can do to save our trees. But sometimes we can't save them all. The campus is growing.
We lost some nice landscaping by Wharton, which my uncle had done.
Really?
And the extension was put up over there. The one thing that I remember is also over what Twin Union, there's that cluster of beech trees there.
Mm-hmm.
That was a huge, huge beech tree.
Right.
It came down on that July 4th. And what is amazing is how much the rest of it has filled in. There were a few sprouts, but it has.
Do you know what July, what year that was?
I probably have it written down in a photo album somewhere.
If you could email that. If you could email me that, I'd like to put that in the records, because that's a clone. That's all clonal. That's all those. That tree never died. That is that tree. So that's all clonal. Yes.
We used to say, I think we still do any job postings for campus jobs. Beautiful park-like site.
Right.
So
Yeah, and the beautiful park-like setting is the work of the landscape architects and the maintenance folks. I just record the trees, so and try to help to preserve the trees. One area I didn't talk about is the Pinetum over at Munn Ice Arena. And, there's a great story about that, too. There's lots of tree stories you can tell. But that was actually planted. If you go back and you read the historical records, how these talk about how North Campus up here was blasted in the wintertime by the sand blowing off of that sand dune. That's an ancient sand dune down there. And so they planted those trees to stabilize that dune and keep the sand from blowing on North Campus. So things like that, I think, help preserve areas of campus, because I don't think anybody's going to build there. I hope not. You never know. Somebody might propose it. Nobody's going to build in the Oval. I hope. I hope not. Beale Garden. Hopefully nobody builds down in Beale Garden. But, some of these areas are hopefully sacred areas for the campus and remain that way. Paul?
Just to mention that one of the things that we're doing with the woods is
trees
that are taken down on campus. We're just starting a wood repurposing. Go online to Penn State Elms and check out their program. They've been doing it about 4 years now. They take the elms that they're losing and then actually repurpose it into furniture and the foam of frames and things like that. So we're starting that here on campus. We take down, unfortunately, about 300 trees a year average. And so all those beautiful trees and wood that used to be just destroyed now will be turned into furniture and to other types. And the big kickoff is Earth Day next year. So you might keep an eye out for it via website
be
able to purchase items from the trees.
What are you calling it again?
It's called the MSU
Shadows
Collection.
Shadows Collection. Yeah, I've been here for 22 years. Paul's been longer than that. When we would do tree removals, they would be sold for firewood, and then we started grinding them up into wood chips and feeding the power plant. But Paul and I, for 15 years at least, and I think just about the time or even before Penn State started their program, said, there's a lot of programs around the world where people take heritage trees and they make something meaningful out of it. Plus, it sequesters the carbon, so it's a great way from a sustainability point of view. It becomes a family heirloom. I mean, it's something that's going to be around for a while. But by taking these old trees that had to come down, either they were lost in a storm or, died from something like elm beetles or something like that or emerald ash borer, we can actually turn something useful into it. And then the other thing is that the money then hopefully will generate enough money to cover the cost of the program, and then the rest of the money would be utilized to plant more trees on campus. That's one of the biggest challenges that we've had has been trying to get money outside of landscape projects. When a project is bid out for construction, for a building, there's a landscape component to it. But landscapes, it's a garden. We're gardening. They don't last forever. Sometimes something needs to be regenerated. Something needs to be revived. And it's always difficult to get money for something that was done 30, 40, 50 years ago to do it again, because it's not a high priority in a lot of people's, except for maybe the people that are in that building, but in general with everything else that goes on campus. And so we're hoping that we can use some of that to generate funds to plant more trees back on campus. Yeah. They're not all labeled. They're all inventoried. And so if we ever get this map up and running on the campus, they will be. I'm trying to get some of the stories, too. It's like if we know when a tree was planted or roughly when a tree was planted, getting that into the database so you can see when the old trees were.
Are the commemorative trees tracked?
The commemorative trees are all tracked in the database as well. And what we want to do is part of this web-based map program is that if you type in a name of a donor or the name of the person being commemorated or the event, that it would take you to that location on campus for that tree.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that would be a time when you could walk up to a tree and with your smartphone find out about the tree.
We have talked about this, actually. And actually, there's two kinds. There's two technologies we've actually explored. And again, the problem is time and money.
Yeah.
Okay? Because, what we actually looked at are RFI chips.
Okay.
So as one possibility. But when we originally looked at it, it was like a dollar a tree, and we've got 20,000 trees on campus at least, and that doesn't count shrubs. The other thing that Jeff Wilson and I looked at, and Jeff kind of is pioneering, was that most devices have a built-in GPS already. And so if you have that link to the campus map with its old GPS-based, then when you walk up to a tree within a matter of a few feet of the accuracy of the GPS, it should be able to tell you what tree you're standing in front of, show it on a map. And that's, so, I mean, these are my dreams. I just don't have the money to do it. We used to have it. We used to have a development officer, but for whatever reason, I don't really know full story behind it. We don't have her anymore, and we never replaced, you know, never refilled the position. So, and now that we've been rolled over into IPF, we used to be a separate division, but now everything's been consolidated in IPF. Now, you know, there's been talk about IPF possibly getting a development officer, but then for all of IPF, then we'd be one small component competing with everybody else in IPF that wants development funds. So it's tricky. It is. Yeah.
Around Beale Garden and elsewhere across campus, there are all those wonderful little signs that talk about either the collection or the species or something else. Are those documented anywhere? Because those are like little pieces of history. And I was wondering.
You mean the plant labels in the garden?
Not the labels themselves, but all of the little signage.
That's, yeah, I mean the little plant, the little squared plant labels engraved.
No, just the stands with the have like the thing lily. Garden down here.
I mean. It's all digital. I mean, that's how we generate it. So, I mean, Jeff, what?
Fantastic.
Yeah. So she's talking like the gold or daily collection sign.
Yeah. So all of that information is kept somewhere, so it's not lost.
Well, we use that because if we have to re-engrave it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, it's just like the pond label and some others. And, you know, there is talk about putting some interpretive panels up. But, again, I have to set priorities based on resources. And my number one resource is keeping up with our plant labels before we start doing interpretive panels. And we've been doing a lot of revision work with Peter coming on board. We'll be able to really, you know, able to revise a lot of, you know, text, bring stuff up to date. Some of the programs that we run, the toxicology program, we've been doing a lot of updating of the toxicology collection and interpretive labels. The science is not static. I mean, the information about plants and their secondary products and their uses changes all the time. And what we once knew about a plant may be completely wrong. A plant that maybe was eaten 30 years ago, we find out it's highly toxic. No, you don't want to eat it anymore.
The names.
Oh, yeah, well, names, I mean, taxonomy is a nightmare because people are constantly changing the names on us, so.
There are some wonderful little trees down by campus, forest planting, or whatever they're calling it these days. What's the story of those?
The which what?
Trees down by campus, parks, and planting.
Campus, park, and planting.
Yeah, that's what it used to be called anyway. Which, you know, down by Case, across from Case.
Physical plants in Lewis. Plants that used to be nursery plants.
Well, Clancy Lewis.
The big oaks, along the extension of Trowbridge Road.
Oh, okay, right.
They used to be around the Quonset huts or the Mary Housing.
Right. What about them?
Well, I was just wondering if there was a particular history to those.
Yeah, I don't know the history on those. What's interesting is we did get a person who contacted one of our landscape architects who just retired about the red cedars that are planted down near the tennis courts. And that her and her father, I guess when he was a student here after the war, you know, the Quonset huts were so sparse, you know, that they planted some of these things out there. And that was kind of a neat story. So, you know, I'm always looking for stories because, you know, and then trying to verify them so they're not just urban legend, but they're actually based in fact. But, you know, my guess is that a lot of those old oak trees predate the campus as well. Probably, you know, they weren't cut down because a lot of that was farmland before it was developed. But they were just probably an island somewhere that they just, yeah, that just didn't cut down. So, yeah. Well, thank you, and I'm glad for all the interest. Thank you.